Can't tell you how many times I've done that.
Well, Dawn did her homework. Thank you, Dawn. She's all alone. The lesson for today is talking about it's ministers of music, clergy set to music. And this one, I don't know, it's not too much of an interesting as some of the other chapters, because it's not maybe as applicable in some ways to the way things are done that we're used to. So in some ways it wasn't quite as interesting to me, and it's a little bit shorter of a chapter. But what I want to do is just kind of go through a few ideas, historical ideas of what he talks about in the chapter, and then I want to ask some questions at the end of class, and see if we can get some good discussion going about this particular idea of not only the whole idea of someone being in charge of music, but also just the whole idea of how music and worship is for us, and how much better it could be in some ways. And I just want us to get into some ideas about that. What I don't want to get into today, because we do not have time to get into this discussion, and I hope we'll have this discussion later on, but I don't want to get into pros and cons or the positives, negatives, right or wrong of instrumental music. Okay, that's not really what this lesson is. He does mention it, and we'll talk a little bit about it, but I don't really want to get into that to that discussion, because I know we don't have enough time to get into it, for one thing. But I'm not prepared to get into it, for another thing, because I didn't really study that in order to, you know what I'm saying. All right. As always, when we've looked at this book, who's our main character in the book, it seems like? Who started a lot of the things, a lot of the traditions that the church as a whole, okay, when I say church, I'm using that very broadly, the church as a whole use within their worship and within their system of doing things. Who's our main guy? Constantine. All right? Just about everything, okay, every one of the pagan traditions that we have talked about can trace at least some of their roots back to Constantine. And why is that?
Because he was such a huge influence as far as that goes. I mean, he was an emperor, which he was the first to make it an official religion.
Okay? He was Roman emperor, and he was a Christian. Okay? And so he tried to combine the two things. He kind of wanted to make life easier for the Christians. You know, they were being persecuted, and they were having lots of issues, and they were not accepted in the general culture. They weren't accepted, and so he tried. I think he was honest in it. He wasn't trying to do these things to make things worse, but he brought in the Roman culture and the Greek culture, and he brought in all these things, and he integrated them with the church, thinking that he was doing them a favor. When in reality, over the course of time, things just continue to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And this idea is no different. Constantine was the very first one who formed and trained and taught groups of people to sing in front of others, the choir. He's kind of the first one that did that. He did it for the reason of he wanted to make worship a little bit more meaningful. He wanted to make especially the Eucharist or the communion, he wanted to make it a lot more meaningful in the worship, in the Mass, or it wasn't the Mass at that time, but in the worship assembly. And so he specially trained, handpicked and trained a group of people to stand in front and to sing special songs during that time. And they became known as the choir. It was done very, very innocently. Actually, the first idea of the choir was to help the congregation. It was just sort of as a, as a reinforcement to what was going on within the congregation, to help them get the pitch and help them to sing the song in the right way. And at this time, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, But at this time, there was no instruments in worship. And so everything was done in a cappella style. And so a lot of it was chanting and those sorts of things. It wasn't a lot of what we would think of as a choir, you know. When I think of a choir, I think of a, for some reason, what comes to my mind is like an African-American congregation, you know, like Sister Act type of stuff, you know, where the choir and everybody's just upbeat and the harmonies are great and, you know, whatever. But in that time, it was more of just, it was more chanting, it was more singing all the same kind of stuff. It was more response and, I forgot what you call it, singing and then responding to the singing. It was more like that. But Constantine was kind of the one that started this whole thing. You know, the worship, it then kind of went into the whole idea of the Mass, and we talked about that a little bit. As things progressed, the Mass became more of a drama than anything else. People came and they were captivated, and they were trying to be entertained, and they were not necessarily entertained, but they were trying to be. It was more like the Greek drama in their culture, and that's kind of how the Mass. It went from more of a worship to where everybody participated in the early church to at some point got to where the congregation almost never did any participation. Stood up, sat down a little bit, said amen, said certain phrases and whatever. But everything else was done by the priest and was done by the clergy and was done by the choir. Everything, all the worship was kind of taken care of. And they were used to that. They were used to going and sitting down. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? They were used to sitting down and watching something happen. And everything was, and you come out with a feeling of holiness, with a feeling of reverence because of the way that it was presented. And so a lot went into it. There was even, the Mass was even seen as magical in some ways. There were some things that happened above and beyond just what happens, you know, in the normal realm. There were spiritual miracles that happened during Mass and all sorts of things like that, you know. That, so it was a little different than what we're used to. By the year 367, congregational singing was banned in most churches. You did not sing because you could not sing. Okay, it was not allowed. And one of the reasons was that they felt like that there was a lot of false teaching and a lot of heresy and a lot of outside influence that would come in, imagine that, would come into the church. And so they wanted to kind of, they didn't want anything. So they had control of everything. Everything was controlled. So when you came to church, you sat down and stuff happened in front of you. I guess you did get to still participate in the Eucharist. I don't know at that point. At some point, even that stopped. The only ones that took the Eucharist were the priests. They took the bread and the wine. You didn't even get to do that. They did it for you, and it somehow transferred over to you. Okay, but they were in control of everything. Everything happened up in front. Everybody sat down, and they were not. I don't mean this negatively, but they were entertained, and it was something that was given to you instead of you participating in. The end of the 6th century, which, you know, there were several years that passed there, was a guy named Gregory. He was a pope that reestablished what he called, what they called the Schola Cantorum. Anybody know what that means?
Cool.
Go on.
Cantorum is okay. Choirs, and Schola is scholars.
School of music, okay, basically is what it is. Okay, special school. It had been established, it had been started several years before that in a lot more of an innocent way, but for this, these singers were chosen, handpicked, chosen, and trained in the school. You had to be in this school in order to pass through and be qualified. You had to go to this school for 9 years. You had to memorize all sorts of everything that you ever sang. You had to memorize, and you had to be trained in all aspects in order to be qualified to be in one of these church choirs, or to be qualified to go and then to train other people to be in this same mode. So it became very serious. All right, you go to school for as long to do this as we go to school to be a doctor today, you know, or some other kind of a profession like that. So it was very serious. You know, I mentioned this just a minute ago, but the Greek culture was built around the dynamic of the audience performer. Performer and the audience. And just about everything they did centered around that idea, and I think we can probably conclude that that dynamic is probably still alive, don't you think? In our church culture, okay, I use that word very generally, that dynamic is still alive. It's still, in most places, very performer audience, even though we would never admit that, even though we would never say that that's the case, and it's probably not the intention. But yet, that's the way it is. Just like when we were talking about the way church buildings are set up, we're talking about the way that we sit in church, the way that we do all these sorts of things, it's the way that we elevate the person that's in the front in most places. You know what I'm saying? So that dynamic, in some ways, is still alive. You know, another thing that was brought in during this time and is very much pagan in its origin is the idea of a funeral. That at somebody's funeral, a clergy person stands up and speaks at a funeral. And he talks about that person's life. And this came from paganism. It was way before the church even came into existence. This was a general practice. And also music being sung at a funeral. They call it the funeral dirge. I don't know. Anyway,
sounds kind of depressing.
So here you have this whole idea. And you know that if you've ever been to a funeral, most funerals are done the same way, right? It doesn't matter what church you go to. It doesn't matter what if the person was a good person, bad person. The funeral, you go there, you're going to have, right, some bells playing Amazing Grace at the beginning. And then, you know, they walk with everybody walks in, you know, in a procession. All of these are... were brought in the Greek culture in this pagan culture. So he just threw that in for free, I think, but it had something to do with the idea of the music that's done. Most funerals are done by who? Got to qualify to be a preacher at a funeral, right? I mean, I have seen a few people that the mom or the dad or. You know, I've even been to a lot of funerals. Unfortunately, I've been to a lot of funerals. Been to a lot of funerals where the guy doing the lesson, the guy speaking about the person, did not even know them. The guy, because they'll stand up and they'll say, "Well, the family gave me all this information about them that I want to share with you." Well, why didn't the family share it? Well, why didn't somebody share it that knows them? Well, because they're not a preacher, right? They're not in that position that they can stand up and they can present stuff. Who would you rather hear say something about you? Somebody that doesn't know you or somebody that does know you? Well, okay, maybe that's the reason that we do that.
I'll do it.
No, I'm making sure I'm saying a lot after you're I don't want any of my youth group guys doing any of anything. But definitely not Jerry. So.
He
walk up to the call video. That's one of our things. Anyway. So it's amazing that how ingrained these pagan ideas. And again, anything wrong with it? Nothing wrong with the funeral and somebody coming up and talking about somebody and it being a preacher. It's not that big a deal. But it's just that we need to realize that these things are not they're not things that are taught in the Bible. They're not really things that are even Christian tradition. They are things that came from paganism. In the late 1300s, early 1400s, John Huss, he brought congregational singing and then he brought instruments into worship in the late 1300s. And as far as we know, this is the first time since the early church that instruments have been introduced into worship. From the very beginning of the church, until this time, there, as far as we know, historically speaking, there were no instruments. From that time until the 1700s, there became like the Reformation and Luther and Calvin. What are they known for? What's Luther and Calvin known for when it comes to music? If you look at our book upstairs, you're going to find there's in the back they have authors and it tells all the songs that these guys wrote. Calvin and John Wesley and Luther and all these guys, they wrote a lot of songs. Okay, and they became known as what?
Hymns.
Hymns. Okay, the church hymns that we sing, okay, that model of doing things came around in 1700s, somewhere in there, brought in by these guys who were the reformers. And they still, when they did that, they still kept the choir, but then they brought in the organ. And the organ then became the centerpiece of how everything kind of went in church music.
Isn't it interesting, though, that they stated here that at first it was only used to provide the pitch?
And then
it moved on from...
Well, and also it was used before and after church as people were coming in or during the offering or during whatever. It became something that they would just... you know, play some things, play some cool music during that. And then it just kind of progressed until it was kind of leading the worship. The guy that was playing the organ was the worship leader. Still with the choir, but everything kind of followed along with that. Organs began being used in mass in the 12th century, and they became standard of Protestants during the Reformation. Choirs had special seats and robes. They would set them right in the front. Right, they had a special place right in the front for the choir. They had the choir, or whatever you call it.
Chancel.
Choir what?
Chancel.
Chancel. Okay? And they would be right up in the front. Everybody could see them. They were leading the worship. And then at some point, actually, in the 16th century, they moved to the back. Up in the balcony, they had this special place for them. But they were kind of unseen. But then, back in the early 20th century, we moved back to the front. And for the most part, any church you go to, where's the choir going to be? That has a choir. Okay, right in the front. Right in the front. So they took back the prominent place. And what do they wear? They come in their shirts like this, and they stand up in the front and sing?
Roots.
Not most times. What do they what?
Roots.
Okay, they can't sing. There's an episode, I know Chris knows going to sing this about, of Andy Griffith, where the choir need new robes. You ever seen that one? They also have one about an organ, too. That's a good one, too, but they can't sing without these new robes, and so there's this big stir in the town that they have to raise a certain money to wear the robes, because choir can't sing without a robe, right? I mean, so they had this whole thing that they were kind of special, that they were different than everybody else. Now what is it? Now the worship team has kind of been introduced, right? It's back in the 60s, kind of, is when late 60s is when the whole idea of worship team, worship band came into prominence. And now, you go to most churches, most contemporary modern churches, what are you going to find? Okay, worship being led, even in churches that don't have instrumental music, you're going to find groups of people, not a choir, but other people, but have a special designation as a worship team. And these guys are a praise team or whatever, and they stand in front or sometimes sit down, whatever, and help to lead the singing. But in most denominations, you're going to find what? A band, a full band, right? And everything has become more rock style, right? Rock style music, more contemporary music than hymns. So that's kind of where we have, come to. Now, I just want to ask a couple questions here. Any comments on any of that I've said?
Well, they had hymns long before Luther and Calvin and all of them. It just had gone away with the formation of the Catholic liturgy. But it came back, was brought back in by Calvin and them.
Was it Ambrose that had the kind of, was a hymn writer back early?
Mm-hmm, early one. But even before that, you know, it even refers to it, you know, they sang, met together and they sang psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. You know, when they would meet in their gatherings, they would sing the hymns, and they would usually tell us, you know, based on a biblical story of sorts.
In our experience, I'll get there in just a second. In our experience, what are we accustomed to? Okay, let's forget the denominational world. Let's forget anything that we're not accustomed to. And let's talk about what we are accustomed to, the way things are done. And again, we're going to just say, generally speaking, okay, because I think things may be done a little differently here than some places. But What are we accustomed to? Nothing.
You talking about isn't like
in our worship as far as music is concerned?
I mean, obviously you got somebody that's a song leader.
Okay.
And he's usually, you know, chooses the songs, and you know, if they're like me, then they get Dave to do the pitch pipe. Can't do that yet, so you know, so you got a little tune pitch, and then they lead it. They get to choose which verses, pretty much. Unless you're at Echo Hills, and you usually sing most of every one of them. And then, I mean, you can, I guess in some ways, they tell you to stand up or sit down, you know, I guess to stretch.
Okay. In most cases, and probably in most of our experience, I mean, that's the way things are done. You have a one designated leader, and most places, it's one guy. I mean, it doesn't matter one or two guys who are quote unquote qualified to do the job for certain reasons. We're talking about some stuff along that line in just a second.
Four part harmony.
Okay.
Typically,
we're used to non instrumental four part harmony. Okay, so you look at the book, and most people look at it and their eyes cross because they have no clue what all the notes mean, right? There are a few. It used to be back 40s, 50s, 60s, where, I mean, there were singing training schools. People would come in, and they would work with the congregation for a week or two every night, and they would do actual training in singing and do the do-re-mi's and all this kind of stuff. Dad still does some of that with some congregations. But, you know, that they knew how to follow the notes, and they knew how to watch and all that sort of thing. We've kind of, I think in our culture, have kind of gotten away from that some. But definitely the way that things are done, yeah.
One of the main thrusts of the Reformation was get the people involved in the worship, especially the singing, I think. And I think that was one of the things that came and went. It came at the beginning, and then as they progressed, I guess progressed, you know what I mean, it got a lot like the Catholic had been before. The clergy and the hierarchical systems came into being again, and it went back to the choir, and it went back to the, you know, scholarly approach versus the people being involved. And that was one of the whole ideas of the reformers in the first place, was to get the people involved, especially the Wesleys. They were very concerned with the spiritual build up of the people. And instead of the entertainment part. Never really fully made it, but that was their idea.
Right. So we have the song leader, okay? Then you know what we also have come into existence in our experience probably, the more of the idea of the worship leader, the worship minister, that he kind of coordinates not only the singing but also the entire service that goes on, right? Makes sure that everything is on time and makes sure all the PowerPoints are taken care of, and it's kind of this the coordinator and the organizer of everything. And then also in our experience, and I know that I've been a few places where this has been the case, is the idea of the praise team. However it's done, whether it's people standing up in the front or people sitting on the front pew, I've been some places where people just interspersed within the audience and they have a microphone. Actually, a couple years ago, our quartet was performing in Arkansas, and we got there on Sunday morning, you know, early, like we normally get there. And we came in, and this guy comes down, and he hands me, and he says, "Hold on just a second." And he puts this thing on me. "What are you doing?" "Oh, no, just don't worry about it. Well, see, I thought that we were probably going to, I thought after the service, maybe they were wanting us to sing a couple songs since we were there that Sunday. Well, no, what happened was they had it on the whole time, and we were sitting out in the audience. I didn't even know I was being... Of course, you couldn't hear it. I mean, they had it so soft. When I realized it, I was like, "What?" You know, take this thing off. No, felt weird. Felt really weird when I found out. I'm glad I didn't know beforehand. I was very self-conscious. I was thinking about it the whole time. You know, I just don't. Anyway, a lot of different ways of doing it. I will say this: most of the ones that I've been to that had a praise team, and again, maybe they just were not good at it, but it didn't work out too well. Really, the ones that I've been involved in, it became more the listening of the audience to the performance of the people that were in the front. Not always. I mean, like I say, I think some churches are very sensitive to that and trying to do a better job with that. But in some cases, in one case, they had a song leader and they had a praise team, and they were like on two totally different beats the whole service. And it was you just sit there and you're like, what beat am I on? You know, you're just trying to, who do I follow? Do I follow the song leader? Do I follow the praise team? Do I just take off on my own, you know, my own beat? So that's what I did, just took off my own beat. And that didn't work out too well either. Okay. Probably for most of us, the idea of a song leader. What are the pros and the cons of the idea of someone leading the worship, the singing?
Keeps people organized would be, I mean, as far as, you know, you're not all just singing your own beat, so to say.
Okay, keep everybody on the same beat and rhythm, all right? Possibly.
Hopefully
it's a song, right?
Hopefully gives a theme to the service.
Okay. Can organize the songs around a specific theme or whatever. Have you ever been to a church that has a really bad song leader? I've been to places where, and I'm not talking about you, Jared.
Okay, appreciate it.
I've been to places where, I'll give you an example. Been with dads singing workshops, and we'll go in there on Sunday morning, and or whatever, and the regular guy will lead the singing. It's just like, you know, I mean, nobody follows him. He doesn't pitch the song right. He does, you know. It's and then dad gets up and leads the same congregation, and it's like we're somewhere else. So a song leader that does pitch the song right and that has some enthusiasm or whatever can help in the spirit of the service. That's for sure.
There's many cases the men of the congregation don't step up and do the job they're supposed to do. So anyone that's either loud enough or willing gets the job. I've been to a place where they literally made the song leader the guy that was the loudest because he was going to lead them anyway. So they just put him. Yeah, but he was. Yeah. And
he just happened to be tone deaf.
He was.
Yeah.
So anyway, but often when you say we want the congregation involved, they won't do it. You know, we've gotten to the point that we've accepted this fact that we have one guy that preaches. We have one guy that leads singing. And for the entire month, we have four guys that stand up front to hand out the Lord's Supper. And that's got to be the way it is. No one else is allowed to do that. And the other people are afraid to even step up and try. Because we've created this mentality that you have to be a trained minister. You have to know music. In most congregations, you know, I've mentioned it before. When people say, what y'all doing? You know, we got seven song leaders. Oh, we could never do that. There's 600 people in that congregation. And they say, we can't find three. Something's wrong. What is it? We've created the mentality that you have to be a professionally trained singer. You can't make a mistake. And I don't know where they're finding these people because most song leaders I know make mistakes. And I'm not trained. I hear them. And I've said, that's the one thing I'm not going to do, lead singing. But I have a different reason for that. Y'all heard my phobia. You know? When you make a 12-year-old song leader, it's not a good idea.
Your voice is going to crack again.
Yes, and it does.
Well, and I mean, we definitely see, there are definitely advantages. And I think the disadvantage would be, and I don't mean to pick Matt so you're singing this part, so you are, right?
I think so.
If you step up,
it may be a very spontaneous service this morning. Matt just kind of easily sing. But the whole idea of the elevation of a person or the qualifications that are needed, anything that we do, if I want to do it, I want to do it my best, right? If I want to speak, it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to be a trained speaker, but I want to prepare, right? I want to be able to do the best that I can do. Same with singing. I don't want to get up there and I don't want to lead singing and know that I'm not good at it. Right? So, nothing wrong with training and preparing yourself and trying to be the best that you can be when you're doing something. But the whole idea of elevating someone to a position that, for one thing, probably nobody's qualified for, but elevating a person to a position that's above and seen as more special than anybody else, I think is a huge mistake. And that mentality is what We have to try to avoid when we have the whole idea of the worship leader or the song leader or whatever.
I've been fascinated. I mean, been listening and participating for, you know, close to 45 years. And how many congregations have you been in where the song leader gets a frog in his throat or just gets choked up and he stops for a moment? The entire congregation goes... You know, a few people keep singing, but the volume and everything just dies.
Yeah. Amazing.
And the moment his voice comes back and he starts again, the volume level is way up. And it's like they can't sing a song that they've sang their entire life unless they hear him.
Or if the song leader misses a verse and goes back to the first verse, everybody just sings the first verse again.
Exactly.
You know, they'll switch back and, you know, whatever. But yeah, it's a mentality of.
No, I have been a place where that was the norm, but they knew that.
Well, missing the verse?
No. Oh. When you followed him, whatever he wanted to do, you did it. And, you know, it's more so in, you know, that congregation went to in Florida.
Ray Walker's that way.
You
better watch him.
Ray used to tell us.
He'll switch songs.
He would very well say. And he knew which songs you were going to do. Say, on this verse, pay attention. We're going to do something that's not written in the book. And which is perfectly fine. But, I mean, we went to the black congregation in Florida. It was the exact same song book. Every song was identical to the ones in our book. Not one of them sounded like the way we sing it. There were verses repeated, and the congregation just watched him, followed along, and it was seamless, because that's what they did. We had trouble following it, but that was new to us, it just because culturally we're used to different things. You know, he would throw in verses that weren't in the book, and they just kept going.
Right.
And they understood it, they knew it, but really the book wasn't necessary. I think the book's a crutch, in a lot of ways, it keeps us from, because we're too focused on the notes.
But so the replacement for the book has become what? The screen. What happens if the dude doesn't switch the screen right?
Where he pushes
the button or he's asleep, he misses the whole last half of the song. It's Amazing Grace. We don't know the verses, right? And so everybody just like,
yeah.
The song leader has got to. You know, everybody knows the song, but so I want to make this, but these couple of statements before we quit. I think we need to be careful of the elevation and the status, you know, and as long as somebody's willing to do it and they're willing to do the best job that they can do and they're willing to work on it, I don't see a point in not allowing people who have the desire to do it. But also, it's just the whole idea of the attitude of the congregation, I think. Being led is one thing. Being stood up and being led and participating in it as if that person just kind of starts the song and keeps it moving and chooses the selections or whatever is one thing. But elevating that person to a status, I know at Rivergate, I shouldn't say that, at another congregation that I went to, I was the song leader that did not want anybody in the pulpit, leading singing, but me. If I was there, I was leading. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, both services on Sunday morning, by the way, had to lead the same exact songs just to make sure that everything was just right. And if I chose somebody, it had to be, you know, I had two choices. You know, they weren't very good ones, but I had two choices to sub for me when I was, you know, when I, whatever. And so they were the acceptable ones. And I'm afraid that mentality, you know, it's very easy to fall into that, even for us. How can the process that we participate in here, let's be very personal, be more participatory? How could it be more to where the congregation feels a part of what's going on? Maybe the way we do it is, maybe it's perfectly fine. Maybe it's great. Maybe it's there's no improvement that can be made. I'll tell you this, a couple weeks ago, I kind of fell into Jared's situation. I didn't realize either I was subbing for somebody or... I didn't realize I was leading singing until we walked upstairs.
He assigned it.
And, I assigned it, and I forgot I was leading it. So I walk upstairs, and so I just walked around, and I went back to Gloria, and I went back to Barbara, and I went back and said, hey, tell me your favorite song.
That's my favorite song.
Never.
Really? And I said, yeah, give me a couple of songs. And she said, Gloria's like, oh, it's that one. Oh, what is it? She can't remember it. And I said, well, Gloria, I'm going to look at you. About, you look for it. I'll look at you about halfway through the service. And I want you to just do the number to me. She's like, really? Well, I won't know it unless you tell me what it is. Unless you want to speak up. No, I'll just do it. So, you know, maybe it's that. Maybe it's asking the congregation for more help in selecting songs. Maybe it's trying to expand the number of guys that we have that actually lead.
You do two today, and he does have today.
Have a few more leaders to lead during each service.
Yeah, it's not dedicated.
There's a lot of different things that can be done to make us feel a little bit more part of the process than just coming in, sitting down, and being led to. And I know for us, you know, we don't have the mic up so loud that it seems like a solo or anything. And, you know, I always hated being up on that elevated podium. I always hated being up. That's so high for our building anyway. But I just felt like that was so disconnected from everybody. You know, it was so much better when I was able to stand down. And I really like it now to where you feel like you're a part. I almost want to get me a chair and sit down, you know, just kind of feel a part. And maybe that's part of it, too.
You also got to figure the fact that when all this came about, they didn't have sound systems.
Yeah.
So the one of the functions of a person up front was so that the people could hear what was going on and what songs they were supposed to be singing.
Yeah.
You know, that was a major factor. And with that's the advent true. Of sound systems, you know, that has more changeable and depending on the size of the congregation and everything. But that was a factor.
Yeah, I kind of had to have the one leader. Let me say this last thing. The more... And Dad brought this up a minute ago, but it seems like the more complicated our worship becomes as far as the process of it, the preparation in it, the more direction and coordination is needed. Right? You will say, well, we want to be more spontaneous, and so we're going to do PowerPoint. There's nothing spontaneous about PowerPoint. Some guys to stay up half the night putting all the songs in. Some guys got to sit up there and flick the button. You know, you got to have all the slides in just right. You got to have all the things. It's a ton of coordination. Just the weeks that we do the PowerPoint for the sermons upstairs, I have to get here like 30 minutes early. I have to put in all of Andy's slides in the PowerPoint. Remember the one Sunday that he gave it to me as we were getting there? But he didn't really give it to me. He gave it to me in Word. So I had to try to pull it up and I had to put it in. And it was, by about sermon time, I had everything in, and then the projector didn't work. But the more complicated we get in the process, the more coordination, but also the less spontaneous and the less spirit-led the worship becomes. It becomes man-led. The more that we have to coordinate stuff. Yes.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen this or had to deal with it yet, but I went to go visit a friend in Knoxville, and we went to a church, and they had a PowerPoint thing going on. But what threw me off was all the background stuff. They had, like, Amber Grains of Wayne actually, like, blowing in the background, actually trying to read the words. My eyes were jumping across because I was trying to go with the words, but the grain was pushing them farther. And then you have like a real deer, like, look up every once in a while, looking around. And I'm like, I don't know where the words are.
Jared Singer's, that deer booty!
Yeah, squirrel. It's so weird. It was so weird. And I'm like, and then I started thinking to myself, I was like, all right, wait a minute. This could split a church. I could see somebody, you know, like some of the older people being like, no, I don't want this. I can't pay attention to where the words are. And others saying, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. I feel like I'm really there. And I'm like, I don't know.
Well,
I see that.
And again, I think every congregation has that decision to make for themselves, right? They've got to make the decision about what works best for them. And I'm not going to tell them or say what they need to do. But for us, and I think we need to realize we have the freedom to figure out what works the best for us. And try to make it the best that it can be for everybody so that we all feel like we're part of the process and participating in the worship. I've been there too. It's like some of them even have like the little ball that goes over the top.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? You know, Sesame Street?
Amazing.
Oh, I can tell you real quick. There is a show, it's for those that have like Comcast or TV. This was, I found this last week. It's really cool. Some of it applies, but you know, a lot of y'all like history. It's called 10 Things You Didn't Know. I don't know if you, they're about 30-minute little segments, and this historian guy does a really good job. It's very kid-friendly. There's no, you know, nothing bad. But one of them was 10 Things You Didn't Know About the Mormons. And he goes all over, you know, one's like 10 Things You Didn't Know About Hitler, or 10 Things You Didn't Know. But some of them does the Mormon one, and then there was another one that had to do with something in the church. They're very, very well done. And things, I mean, literally, when you think 10 Things You Didn't Know, the Mormon one was just, wow. I just kind of blew my mind, some of the things that they said. But anyway, so if you have Comcast or you do the things, it's in that first, like, A through whatever, in the alphabetical. Mm-hmm. It's under that, and it just says 10 things. It doesn't finish 10 things. The title. But anyway.